Hello, and welcome to another episode of Successes in the Mind with me, Oliver Bruce, and Hugo Tilmouth. Today, we're joined by George Taylor, the visionary founder and CEO of Thrive, the UK's highest rated meal prep delivery service. Thrive is transforming healthy eating by delivering chef-prepared, nutritionist-approved meals directly to your door. With a commitment to using 100% whole food and eliminating artificial ingredients, George has made it easier than ever to enjoy delicious, balanced meals without the hassle. Under his leadership, Thrive has delivered over 10 million meals, helping countless individuals prioritize their health and well-being. Join us as we explore George's entrepreneurial journey and how he's making healthy eating accessible for all.
I'd done a 68-hour shift once where I actually built a factory. My addictions disappeared because of my business, because I had something to really hone into and give me discipline. And I knew that if I carried on the way I was, I wouldn't be able to be successful in this.
How do you instill a culture of high performance in your business?
When I first started, I'd just walk around like throwing people like pay rises. The key to food is love. And if you give love to food, it will love you back and it will make amazing food. And if it's not something that we can't get without one chemical in it, we don't use it and we'll make it ourselves.
How did you have the cash flow to do that when you were bootstrapping?
No, I did make a commitment never to lie, never to litter, never to steal ever again in my lives. Honestly, I was doing like regular 30 plus hour shifts.
Wow.
Working through the night, through the day, I was cooking, delivering, I was going to source the ingredients from the markets in the middle of the night. I was building all of these relationships. If we can send rockets to the moon, why can't we grow organic produce everywhere rather than pumping it full of insecticides and pesticides?
So, George, you've got a 60 million quid business now. Dial it all the way back to when you were at school when you were a kid. Did you want to go into business?
Well, I think I actually always knew that I was an entrepreneur. Even at school, I was in year eight, year nine, selling sweets to, you know, going to the sweet shop before school, buying sweets and even cigarettes, actually. and selling, you know, buying a pack of cigarettes for like 70 quid or a pack of 20s, actually. Yeah, I managed to work my way into the shopkeeper at some point. And I was selling them for 50p a cigarette. And I was like doing deals on, you know, Yorkie bars and Haribo packs, early doors. So I kind of knew I always had an entrepreneurial spirit. I then, when I was in school, I started like buying and selling phones and repairing them, selling them on eBay. So I liked earning, you know, that bit of cash. I'm not sure if it was ever with cash at the forefront of it. I think I just really enjoyed, you know, the challenges of trying to kind of flip things and I like the idea of like buying one thing at one price and then splitting it down and buying it into selling it at a higher value. And yeah, that kind of started the journey of entrepreneurship.
What would you have done if you hadn't actually realized that you enjoyed that? So you're buying cigarettes, buying sweets, selling them, making margin, making money. But yeah, did you ever have a backup plan? Because you can't leave school and that'd be your career.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I never necessarily enjoyed being in school. I was always like one of the naughty ones in school.
No, really?
yeah, spent many of days in withdrawals and I actually got kicked out of school in the last year. So it was all fun and games when I was younger. But just going back to your question, I was always pretty smart at the same time. I got, when I exited school or was exited from school,
It's not selling a business. You don't exit school. I love the rebrand there. Yeah.
Which was about 6 months before my GCSEs. They handed me these like papers ready for my GCSEs before I started a couple of weeks before. And I went and like, I literally just digested them. I went and got an A star, two A's and all B's. Wow. In my GCSEs. But I just never really enjoyed kind of sitting there, just sitting at a table. I like doing lots of different things at lots of different times. Which has probably led into being able to, you know, I'll tell you a little bit more shortly, but, you know, the journey of Thrive and Lions Prep and, you know, all of the different bits and pieces that I've done along the journey. It's kind of where I thrive.
What were your parents like then when you got kicked out of school? Were they supportive? Did they care? Were you kind of thrown out on your own? What did that look like as a kid? And what sort of molded your kind of resilience that you've got now?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up with my mum and my brother in my house. I'm from a place called Ilford, which had its own challenges. It was quite a rough environment for me when I was younger. Kind of went down some wrong paths for a little bit of my life. So definitely, you know, the environment that I was in built a level of resilience inside of me. Yeah, I would say that you know, not to go into in too much detail, but I wasn't always the most well-behaved kid when I was younger, you know, all the way in, you know, I'll go into it shortly, but, you know, the business was actually a massive turning point for me in my life. I was kind of heading down quite a destructive path. So yeah, the resilience was born, I think, potentially from kind of just having a single parent household, and me and my brother used to kind of get into battles every now and then, physical and mental. But look, we're, you know, the journey of being a child in an environment like I was in is always going to be quite challenging. So yeah, I think that's probably what built my resilience.
So you're exited from school. What happens next?
So I got put into the naughty kid place, which was called Connections, where you're taken out of school and put in like a, it's like a community where you are still doing bits and pieces. But fortunately, in fact, it was actually a great thing that happened to me because, you know, I was given the opportunity to get a plumbing apprenticeship. That Connections was like somewhere where, you know, they do actually support everyone and the children that are in their environments quite well. So I was blessed with a plumbing apprenticeship with a company called Briggs & Forrester, which I started when I was 16. And it was a four-year apprenticeship. And as I was in there, I, you know, progressed very quickly through that apprenticeship. And, you know, within 2 years, I was doing work that, like, the guys that had been there for like 30 years were doing. You know, I was brazing dry risers and, you know, big high temperature guns in tiny little cupboards, doing welding and stuff like that, building plant rooms. But yeah, once again, I kind of didn't necessarily feel appreciated in that job. It was very much kind of political, you know, there was a lot of hierarchy there, and I'm not a great believer in hierarchy. I like to be like with the guys on the ground and, like, you know, blending in with a team. And, you know, if you come to my factory, you'll see that, you know, all my guys are, they love it, you know, that there's not a, oh, George is here, that everyone look down. It's very much of a welcoming environment. So, yeah, two years into that, I kind of started having problems in that workplace. Just they weren't paying the money that I was earning, and little bits and pieces. I was on price work, and I'd get in earlier than everyone. I'd work through my lunch. I'd leave later than everyone, and I'd do like twice the amount of work for half the price, and they still weren't paying me. So, yeah, annoyingly, I had a few kind of blow ups with some of the management there about that, but I think I was building a reputation in the country as like the number one apprentice. And I actually got chosen to do a higher national curriculum in engineering from JRL, something, which was the apprenticeship scheme. I forgot what it was called now. But I, this was like on the third or fourth year of my apprenticeship that I got chosen to do that. And it was either I'll stay in this company. They wouldn't give me an extra day off because they had a problem with me at that point, because I'd kind of, you know, I had a few arguments in the office about my money and stuff. So they wouldn't give me the additional day off to do that. So it'd mean that I'd have to do an additional day. And I decided not to. And I actually left that apprenticeship because, I just felt like underappreciated. And I knew that they didn't want me to succeed. And I'm one that always tries to break through barriers and, you know, through hard work, resilience, discipline. So I left Briggs & Forrester, which was the plumbing apprenticeship. And then that company, JBO, I think it was called, JLS or something like that.
I think that's a BAMS.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. They found me a job with a company, with a mechanical and electrical company, where they brought me in as a contracts manager. And there I learned, you know, I actually come off the phone to my boss, who was my boss then, he's doing work in the factories for me now.
So your boss now works for you?
No, he doesn't work for me. He still owns the same company, but where for the mechanical and electrical work,
right,
he came in.
Right. I thought he
great. Shit, honestly, one of the most respected people, like intelligent people that I've ever met, taught me so much about leadership and the importance of planning and teamwork. Yeah. And, you know, some of that real foundational skill sets that's allowed me to build the business that I've got now came from him. Super respected guy as well in kind of his space. So yeah.
So you're onto this is it engineering degree or what?
No, I didn't end up doing it in the end. I stepped away from it because that company didn't actually allow me to take that extra day. So I thought to myself, this isn't my path. And then I was given that opportunity at the same time it was all happening. So I kind of jumped ship and went in a more managerial role where I was, I was actually going to speak to the clients, price the work, do all of that client relationship management and win projects for them. I mean, I won them in the second year, a £2.4 million contract, which was the biggest contract that, I say I won. I was a front runner on it, but obviously Steve, who was my boss then, obviously supported from the back end. But one a £2.4 million project, which was by far the biggest project they'd ever done. So I was excelling in that.
And you would have been what age at this point?
I was probably touching 20, around 20, I would say. You know, maybe 21, I think. Yeah, 21.
What strikes me is the hierarchy sort of doesn't agree with you. Like, you don't agree with hierarchy. It doesn't agree with you.
Yeah.
And if you're not feeling nurtured, you don't necessarily thrive.
Yeah.
What have you sort of taken away from that learning and put into your business? Because there's so many people that go straight into business.
Yeah.
And they haven't had the chance to learn or be employed by anyone. So then they can't implement things they don't like because they don't know what they don't like.
Yeah.
But you've experienced things you don't like. So if you were to sort of explain how you went from that in your business, what does that look like?
I think for me, like, honesty is always like the number one on the agenda. And I think that comes through from just the product. You know, you can see that our product that we sell is extremely honest and trustworthy. And I think that like the willingness to make mistakes and like own the mistakes is something that I've always been passionate about. And to be honest, when I started, I mean, I'll go into a little bit more where I started and I could probably tell you a little bit about the journey there, but I kind of got myself into a really dark place, actually. When I was 23, I was, addicted to several things that I shouldn't have been, in an environment where, you know, there's a lot of pressure. You know, it wasn't a positive environment, really negative environment. I was taking drugs, I was drinking too much, and kind of hit rock bottom at that point. So that humbled me to some respect, because I was, you know, when you're at rock bottom, there's only one way to go. I went to a boot camp in Ibiza, basically, to get clean for like 7 days. And I went there and I met some really fantastic people. I met a guy called Steve, who's been like a big life mentor of mine not on a professional level, on a personal level, you know, showed me God and all of the kind of right ways to live life. And I didn't necessarily grab it there and then, but like as the years have gone by, I've become like more closer to him and like closer to the beliefs that he was not inflicting on me, but showing me at them early stages of my business. But yeah, I went to a boot camp in Ibiza, and there was these two of my really good friends actually were talking about this girl that was cooking meal prep in Camden. She was like 7 years old. She was the front face of this company, and they were doing like 170 meals. And I didn't realize it then, but at that moment, but at that point, I'd met my first chef, who was actually at that boot camp. I met Steve, who's been that life mentor to me. And I was like in an environment of like born again Christians and like really well respected people that had kind of done stuff with their life. And I'd never really experienced that. It was always kind of, you know, growing up in an environment where there's like a lot of gangs and, you know, like crazy things going on around me. So I'd never really had inspiration of like who I wanted to be. And I came back from my Ibiza and kind of relapsed back into my old ways. And then within about 2 days, I remember laying on the sofa and my two friends were back came to my apartment where I was staying, and they was talking about this girl again. And then bam, something in my body just like happened. And I tell this story and I know now that that was God, and God come and grabbed me and just pulled me out of the situation I was in and gave me the new mission and purpose, which was Lions Prep, which has manifested itself into something far bigger and where I am today, which I can go into like the vision and the mission of the company a lot and the purpose of the company a bit more shortly. But yeah, that journey. And then from that point, like to today, I've just given absolutely everything to this project. But going back to the question that you asked me about what did I learn and how have I kind of implemented some of the stuff that I didn't like into my business, I think that really humbled me, that whole experience there. And it created a level of, my addictions disappeared because of my business, because I had something to really hone into and give me discipline. And I knew that if I carried on the way I was, I wouldn't be able to be successful in this. And it was like this new given purpose. So I just threw myself into it. And honestly, I was doing like regular 30 plus hour shifts.
Wow.
Yeah. Like working through the night, through the day, I was cooking, I was delivering, I was going to source the ingredients from the markets in the middle of the night. I was building all of these relationships. You know, we was working out of some dingy little kitchen in Bethnal Green to start with, which was fun and games. I've got a few pictures where like the extraction just didn't work one point, and you'd like walk in and it was just like the door was here and it would just be smoke and you would be able to see to the other end of the kitchen. So yeah, good times. And I think just that real raw organic way of building a business has kind of continued to where I am today. It's like really honest, really trustworthy. The hierarchy thing, if I'm not willing to do it, why am I expecting someone else to do it? So I'm very much someone that leads from the front.
Yes.
You know, even last year, I was on the production floor helping sort out shifts that were new when, you know, we was going through some difficulties operationally. And, you know, if someone called me today and said, look, there's an issue at the kitchen, I'd be the first person there to kind of jump on the floor and work with the guys to kind of support them, but make them feel like, you know, I don't want anyone in that company to ever feel like, you know, it's being just pushed on them and yeah, there's a problem. Well, you're just fixing it and that's just it. Like, I want to be the person that's the face that keeps morale up to show that from top to bottom, we're all invested into this company. And, you know, I've got about 320, 330 people that work for me now. And, you know, a lot of some of them people I don't know as much anymore, you know, but there's still a lot of like really familiar faces, like, you know, minimum of 100 that know me and like, you know, we have a chat when we see each other, but everyone is like super invested into this business. And I think that having raised no money and building the business to where I've got to now, I mean, that's an indication that there's been an extreme amount of investment and commitment by a very large amount of people, because there's a lot of things that have gone wrong, like a lot of things that have gone wrong, and people just do. And, you know, I've got guys in that factory that will stay there for 24 hours if they need to and just commit to it and get it done, because we're like, we're a team and we've kind of built this raw organic relationships together, and they've seen me do crazy things, like, and now it's, you know, I know that I can trust the people there and they're going to do their absolute best to get the job done. And yeah, I think that's kind of been built from a level of transparency, a level of commitment, hard work, and honesty, I would say.
And how do you make sure, I guess then, that you're kind of rewarding them how you want to be rewarded, right? You said you weren't necessarily being looked after or rewarded when you were at the plumbing business.
Yeah.
You're putting in extra time, you weren't rewarded for that. The guys that are working through the night for you, do you give them a golden handshake? Do you look after them? Are they in the business because they want to see the business succeed because they've got shares? Like, how do you instill a culture of high performance in your business?
Yeah, definitely something I'm struggling with right this second. And I'll go into that just as the business has grown. But like when I first started, I'd just walk around like throwing people with like pay rises. They do like something great. And obviously it was just me. So I was just like, yeah, I love you. I'm just going to give you an extra bit of this and it. And it was like, it was great for that early stage morale and early stage of running a business. But I think like, you know, it can only get to a certain point where you're doing that, because then it's like, well, what about me? People are sitting there probably going, what about me? So one thing I have done is issued like EMI share options to a vast amount of people in my business. So everyone's got that kind of piece of the pie and they've got skin in the game, which I think really helps. I've carved out between 12 and 15% of the company to go to my employees. And we've issued, you know, quite a lot of those, and, you know, we've still got a bit of room to hire more people and attract more talent, of course. But yeah, no, everyone's, you know, everyone's paid well. We're not an underpayer. Like we're one of the higher payers in our space and kind of generally around, the industries, DC industries. I've always been a good payer. I think we're flexible. I think we care about the employees that work for us. And if anyone's got an issue, we're the first people to jump in. You know, I've done little things for people, like just one-on-one. Like there's a guy that creates music in my business, and I got him a studio day one time, and we sat in the studio and I tried to support that journey. And, you know, any opportunity that I see like that, as long as I can actually do it financially, I'll do it. But going back into what I was about to say around it's a bit more challenging now. Obviously, to do, we've recently brought in a people director. The people department is, it's a tough nut to crack, to be honest, to get it right. You know, culturally, we went through some stuff last year, which was quite challenging. So culturally, we've been impacted there. But I think with all negative, I've got a saying, like, there's no such thing as a negative, it's just a positive in disguise. So with last year's kind of turbulence that we experienced, that we've thankfully got through now, there's been a nice kind of opportunity to reset culture. And what I'm really pushing from the people department is like very clear career development, so people can walk into work and they know that if they do X, Y, Z by this point, they're going to be this, or they're going to get paid extra by this. And it gives everyone a nice way of, you know, targeting themselves to, you know, I want people working their hardest for me in the business, straight. Do you know what I mean? And but I don't want them to do that without being rewarded at the same time.
Got clear banding structures, I guess, in place now.
Well, not...
Or get it.
It's happening, yeah. It's one of... Within the Q1, we're going to be in a position where, yeah, everyone's going to have a career roadmap in which they can kind of work towards, and something that I'm extremely passionate about, and that probably... As you probably stems from those times. I've not thought about it like that. Yeah.
100%. Yeah. And I guess just double clicking on that bit, when you were sort of bootstrappy at startup, scale up kind of entrepreneur, and you were running around the factory floor going, oh, you, Bob, are going to have a pay rise. You, Mary, are going to have a pay rise. One Elliot, right?
Yeah. I think Mary was one of them, actually.
Really? Yeah. So, I'll research as a guest. How did you have the cash flow to do that when you were bootstrapping? Because you had no seed.
God, no.
Putting to the bit.
Yeah.
Where did cash come from?
Yeah, God, no. You know what? I do not know how I did it. I think that I've never taken money out of business. I've always invested everything back in it. Somehow we was loss making for the first few years, or like the from year three to like year five, year six, I think we was loss making.
Without capital being injected, still lost.
Yeah, without capital being injected, yeah, debt. I mean, we took on some debt.
Okay.
Yeah, we was. Yeah, that was one thing that I've built the business on is debt.
Right.
You know, asset finance. When COVID happened, we was able to get the CBILS loan, and that was actually you can very clearly see the impact of some cash coming into the business. That I think we got 250 grand from the CBILS loan facility that the government put out for COVID, and that instantly changed things. That was the first amount. That was the first kind of decent amount of cash that had come into the business.
Really.
Yeah, so...
But you were already quite substantial at that point.
What year was that? I found out COVID was 5 years ago. I mean, I can't remember what the revenues were. It was probably a couple of million in year three.
Bootstrapped to a couple of million, and you'd never taken any money, and the first money coming in was 250K. You know, most people have already raised millions of pounds before they even hit their first million of revenue. You know, you've done it.
I don't know, mate. I never did that.
We'll just take a quick pause there. We'll get back to the episode in a minute. But I just wanted to say thank you to you guys who are listening to this episode, who are subscribing and following the podcast. If you haven't already, please do hit that follow and subscribe button. And maybe you can also share it with friends, with family, and with colleagues to hopefully inspire them on their entrepreneurial journey. Genuinely, we can't do this podcast without you. So thank you. Let's get back to the episode.
Yeah, I feel, you know what? I just think like, food is something that if you can get right, it can be quite profitable. Like, yeah. We're a subscription company. Our working capital cycle is like -5 days. So I think that's always helped. We've got the money in the door. We've then paid for all of the produce to sell, and then we have 30-day payment terms on that. So you can kind of cash flow. We did cash flow it. When you start getting into kind of CapEx investments, investing into equipment and factory, obviously, you know, if I'm continuously investing all of the gross margin into people and overheads, you know, that CapEx investment becomes difficult. So early stages, I can kind of remember now, right. Like early stages, I was going down a scrapyard in Bermondsey, trying to find kitchen equipment, buying secondhand, third hand grills and stuff like that. So I think I just beg, steal and borrow, but I didn't actually steal.
That was a previous life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I did make a commitment never to lie, never to litter, never to steal ever again in my life. So, Yeah, so I kind of beg, stole and borrow without the stolen part my way through it. You know, my mum lent me some cash, pretty much all of her life savings she lent me, which beautiful woman she is. She's been supporting me on the journey from the day one as well. She works for me now. She's the bookkeeper.
Is she?
No one better than your mum to manage the money coming in and out.
Absolutely. She cares more than anyone else in the world, I'm sure.
Yeah, she is. She's amazing. Like, she's really committed her life to me. So, I really appreciate that. And I can't wait to kind of just give it all back to her.
Yeah, that's so amazing. That's great. And so, you know, obviously you've had this amazing journey, to founding the business. And you were telling us before we started rolling about people ripping you online for saying, you know, you're this privileged guy, all of this kind of stuff. Do you want to just tell that story?
Yeah. So I've just started getting in front of the camera a little bit more now. The last kind of 7-8 years, I've been building a big operation. So I've not necessarily had the mind, the headspace to be going to get on camera and going to be a bit more front facing. But yeah, recently the team's in a good place. So I've been able to start kind of turning outwards of the business and, you know, doing podcasts like this and speaking a little bit more on camera. So no one's really seen me. We put an ad out, I think it was like the back end of last week, which has done phenomenally, by the way. It's the best ad we've actually launched, where I'm talking about the vision and the company and, what we're here to do, which I'd like to tell you a little bit more about. But in the comments, I'm trying to sit in these conversations, in these podcasts, trying to talk a bit prim and proper, really trying to sound quite professional. And it went the other way. So in the comments, there was people saying, who's this privileged guy talking like a roadman or trying to be a roadman or something like that? And you can see it's just like the funny comments. Some people are like, which is nice, it's like, I trust this guy more than I do kind of like the kind of government and the posh guys. I saw one who's like, this guy's from the road or this guy's from the ends, which I actually am, which is jokes. I think it's quite unique to do what I've done. And I think people are going to be able to relate with this kind of story as I grow. And yeah, to be honest, I'm really here to just like, I really love humanity and I really don't like what is happening to humanity. Specifically in my space with the food system all of the toxic chemicals that are implanted into our system. I mean, ultimately, if we can send rockets to the moon, why can't we grow organic produce, you know, everywhere rather than pumping it full of insecticides and pesticides, which is ultimately shouldn't be in our body. You're getting my passion coming out now.
So the mission, the vision then of the business currently is also the healthy part of it. Yeah, that's what stems that, right? That's what you want to instill in people.
Yeah, so I said earlier about God coming to grab me out of that situation. And, you know, what that took me on was a path of Lions Prep. And Lions Prep was about, you know, I started in my apartment. I was cooking for 7 of my friends. I think the first cook was 36 meals and it took me about 36 hours. And even my mum from early days, I got to a point where I'd like, burnt out and I'd cooked all the food. I'd gone and bought all the food, processed the orders all on paper, cooked it all. And I was in a position where I just didn't have like the capacity or like the thinking ability to pack the meals into the boxes. So I just called my mom at like 7 in the morning after doing like 36 hours, smoked my kitchen out. And she came and just packed all the meals up for me. And I went to sleep for a few hours, woke up and they were all kind of set up and ready to go. So, and then, yeah, 7 of my friends, that was for that first cook. Yeah, kind of went on that journey of Lions Prep. And Lions Prep was kind of, you know, it was a meal prep company. It was to make meals convenient for people that wanted to go to the gym. Lions Prep, it was quite a masculine brand. To every 30 to 40 year old male that I say, you know, we've rebranded, they're like, why did you rebrand? We love the name. And I'm like, yeah, you love the name, but I wanted a name that was much more mass market, catered to a much wider audience.
So it was more friendly as well with the visuals.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So you know, in 2022 was that kind of repurpose moment where I began to get like really passionate about what we're putting into our bodies. You know, I'm now a food entrepreneur. I've sold millions of meals. People are loving the food. They're loving the taste. And I'm in the kitchens. I run the kitchen for 3.5 years. I was in, I mean, on and off, like I'd have chefs come in, come out, but I was the kind of stable person I'd do. I remember listening to Bob Marley on the grill. I used to love being on the grill, just whipping the grill up with like loads of chickens and steaks and lamb chops. And I used to have Bob Marley on in the background in the middle of the night, doing silly hours. And it was just like this really fun journey. So I'd seen food, and I'd seen food for what it really is. And, you know, early stages, we was buying in kind of like curry pastes and, you know, sauces and stuff like that. And we was using ketchup. And I'd look at it all and I'd go, this isn't food. Like, this is not how it was made for us. I didn't necessarily make a change there. But all of these things, I think, were just embedded in my mind. And then in 2022, I was like, right, I want to strip all of this stuff out of the food, and I want to be in a position where we're making everything in-house with raw spices, raw herbs to make our flavors. And I met my executive chef, Reese, he's been here now 4 years. So in 2020, just at COVID time. And he came in, and I'd been trying to find a chef that could execute things how I wanted it to. Chefs are hard work.
Yeah, they are.
They've got big egos. Yeah. You know, they're very, you know, many a times I had a chef come in that was like, yeah, George, right, let me do this now. And it just went the other way. You know, that passion that I had for the business and the food was like something that kept the food like really good. The key to food is love.
Yeah.
And if you give love to food, it will love you back, and it will make amazing food.
That's why I can't cook.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah. So I met Reese, and Reese was, he's still with me now, he's the executive chef, or he's actually the head of food operations now. It's a much kind of more food manufacturing role that he's got embedded into the NPD department. But he was the first person that came and took that kitchen off of me, who I could trust and leave it with. So then the strategy started, which was like me basically going, right, food strategy, what we're doing. I started building out the kind of back offices, the marketing department, and, you know, the business quite rapidly started to grow from that point. And I think in our numbers, you kind of see it. Mm. I mean, we've always grown like 130% year on year, like as an average. Yeah. Last year was a little bit different. We rebranded and we had some kind of operational issues early doors, which I can go into a little bit more.
There's still 35% odd, you said.
We grew 50% last year. Yeah, we grew 50% last year. And it was a terrible year, like terrible.
That's nuts.
So that journey with Reese coming on board, 2022, I had this like light bulb moment where I was like, right, I'm taking all this stuff out of the food, which is no one's done it. There's not one restaurant that does it. We're the first people.
Not even one restaurant. Wow.
Yeah, no, restaurants are, look, you know, that's... I don't know that for a fact, right? But like generally you'll find in kitchens, and I've gone and done a lot of kitchens, like in service kitchens before. I've gone and done a lot of like voluntary shifts in service kitchens before. Yeah. You know, they're using refined sugar. They're using like bad quality ingredients that they're making taste nice through salt and butter and stuff like that. But generally, like, you know, the curry paste is still there. Yeah. These bits and pieces, they're still there. I mean, look, if you go to, I'm sure if you go to like a restaurant that is like really focused on that, you'll find, and there are people that are really passionate and how I am about the food industry and their restaurants. I'm very much sure that they're making everything from scratch, but generally like restaurants are, you know, we'll buy the...
Well, I guess it saves time and cost, and yeah, you know, labor is so expensive here. So
it's the path of least resistance.
Exactly, yeah, and it makes it easier for everyone. But you know, with ease, sometimes you get a negative impact of that. You know, never take the easy route is one something, a motto that I live by. So we spent a year pretty much refining our recipes. Reese, you know, played a big part in that. The procurement team played a huge part in that, refining our recipes. And we do outsource some stuff. You know, we are sourcing certain like sauces, like oyster sauces or teriyaki sauces or something like that. But it's all clean deck. Like, we've got a rule that they can't
source book control.
Basically. Yeah. So, you know, the procurement team aren't able to buy anything with a chemical in it. So it's all natural. Like every single mouthful of food that you eat with Thrive is 100% natural. And people say 100% natural, great. But I'm talking about going down the supply chain, looking at that curry paste, and if it's not something that we can't get without one chemical in it, we don't use it and we'll make it ourselves. So we are looking at, you know, cutting corners, we're buying stuff in, but only with very strict guidelines to make sure that, you know, if I don't understand it and you don't understand it, any of these ingredients, it's not in the food. And that's down to the source. And we've already gone one step further into the actual growth of the food, which is, you know, we're on a journey to allow everyone to eat organic.
Yeah.
Because, you know, our conventional food that we all eat is sprayed full of insecticides and pesticides, which is killing our bodies. You know, if you look at the global health statistics, we're dying as humans. You know, every cancer is one in two people.
It's
mad. Obesity is through the roof. And, you know, if you look at it from 1960 to see how it's deteriorated with the introduction of a lot of ultra processed foods, you know, a big part of that, but also the population has grown vastly since that point. And, you know, to cater for that vast growth, they've just cut corners everywhere, left, right, and center in food growth, agriculture. You know, if you look at, you know, some of the fish farms are just,
yeah,
it's crazy. And we're not given visibility to that. And what Thrive is here to do is to transform that, to transform health,
yeah,
by revolutionizing eating habits and restoring food back to its natural form. That's actually our vision statement.
Because you've got 22,000 people that believe in that now.
Yeah.
You've got 22,000 customers. But when you started to go down that route of having it solely organic, making it in-house,
yeah,
doing it where it's properly healthy.
Yeah.
Was that A, cost prohibitive, and would that have made it really expensive for the customers at the first, you know, point of iteration?
Yeah.
Because how does your price point differ to the, yeah, you know, the Gustos and the HelloFreshes?
Yeah. 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 We're slightly more expensive at the minute.
Because it's more premium.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Like, you can definitely taste. I mean, the Gusto and the HelloFreshes, they're recipe kit boxes, right? So, you know, we are cooking the food. So naturally it is more expensive anyway. But in terms of my competitor space, we have actually got an initiative this year to reduce our prices by, you know, between 5% and 10%. To open ourselves up to a wider audience with some initiatives to allow people to have one meal a day. At the minute, we've got a restriction of you have to order two meals a day. It can be a breakfast and a meal, but you have to order two meals a day, and our shelf life's tight. We're extending our shelf life in Q1, which will allow us to reduce our prices slightly and also allow for people to have one meal a day.
That would work better for me because I've never eaten two meals.
Yeah,
eight,
well, that's
three, I just don't eat much.
Yeah, that's where our competition have got an edge on us at the minute. So, it doesn't go down well with me. So I want to make that change pretty quickly. You know, I think the quality of food in the space that we're in, like, you can clearly see that, like, we're,
like, streets ahead. I tried the product just before Christmas, and the food is actually excellent. Like, I've tried those meal box things, and, like, the chicken turns up, and it's just, like, it's not good stuff, you know. But
shriveled.
Yeah, like, it is really, like, not high-quality food at all. But I really enjoyed it. I think it's great stuff.
Because what's the price point for you guys?
Good question. It's always someone always asks me this question, but we've got so many variations. Yeah. We've got, like, kind of the lower price meals that are at £7. You know, we've got a medium price meal, like the kind of steaks and stuff at 10. And then we've actually got a premium range, which are like £17, where, you know, we're delivering free, like, beautiful lamb chops on the bone, you know, super succulent, but yeah, they're obviously more expensive.
And that's enough to last you how many days then for £17?
£17 is, there's a meal that is £17. Oh. Yeah, but obviously the quality of the ingredients is, like, one of them's a ribeye steak with asparagus and stuff like that. You know, we're still significantly lower than what you'd buy that in a restaurant. It'd probably be like £30-40, and the quality wouldn't be there either.
So the fact that you can literally produce all of the ingredients, cook all of the ingredients, get them to someone's house, all for £7 a meal. That seems almost impossible to me. Like, how on earth can you do that and also have high quality ingredients?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we have a minimum order per box. So, you know, that creates, you know, from our COGS, a meal, as many meals as we can in a box is something that we're looking for to try and bring the price down of the cost of the delivery and the packaging. But we've also been given quite a lot of support. I think a lot of the partners that I work with, you know, we've built really strong relationships from packaging companies and logistics companies, and they're actually supporting our journey as well. You know, Google are now beginning to support our technology journey. I think a lot of people are believing in what we're doing.
Yeah.
And I think people are kind of just sick of the food system, you know, and starting to get real visibility and clarity as to what these things are doing. I mean, in the media alone, you're looking at a huge rise, and, you know, people like Chris Van Tulliken and stuff like that, you know, they created the Ultra Processed People book, which is what I actually give out to all my staff when they join. you know, these people are raising awareness of the food system and how it impacts our health. So, you know, as a company, it started as a meal prep company and it still is a meal prep company, but just with a much larger vision and purpose to really kind of cure humanity, I think is my mission, and allow people to trust the food that they're eating. And, you know, a big part of our content strategy will be around transparency.
Yeah.
Showing people how we're making the food and, you know, stuff like my competition, like a lot of those are outsourcing the food that they're creating and outsourcing the fulfillment. And, you know, which means that they've not got much control over what's happening and they're just generally marketing companies.
So just double clicking then on that Google piece, right? Because there's a lot of tech behind the scenes. Yeah. It's not just a meal prep business, for instance.
Yeah.
But when you first started, you invested pretty heavily in tech, be it in sort of technical fridges or whatever. Why have you put so much technology into a business which is seemingly quite simple? You cook, you deliver, that is it.
Yeah. Well, to enable me to change the food system and get everyone back to organic and how nature made it for us and how God made it for us without all of the sprayed insecticides and stuff, you know, it's impossible to do that at a cost that's available to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, with technology and with what's happening in the AI space, what we've got is a platform which will allow us to optimize our operations, optimize our processes, you know, remove some of the admin duties that happen in the business. And with those savings from people, process and efficiencies, we'll be able to reinvest those savings back into the produce line and go on a journey of where we are currently at 30% organic, slowly invest further and further into produce without passing that cost on to customers to grow to 100% organic. And that's a journey. That's not going to happen overnight. You know, that strategy is, we've got the next years of strategy, but realistically, this is going to be a 5 to 10 year strategy of becoming 100% organic because, you know, ultimately the soils and the agriculture and the farmers are going to need to innovate at the same time. Our soils won't be able to do it at the minute. They're burdened soils now. You know, they've been sprayed with all of these chemicals for so long. They need time to revitalize.
The soil is dead, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And England once had the best soil. And that's why the Vikings come here. but yeah, so it's going to take time, but, you know, I'm starting to build relationships with British farmers and getting into those institutions. And I want to be known by them to allow, you know, to give them hope. I think right now the support from the country into farmers is disgusting.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately that is the life source of humanity that they're neglecting there. And, you know, I kind of want to step up and be that D2C mechanism that can really drive innovation and a healthy agricultural environment in the country.
Obviously, there's lots of different people in the space. You know, you guys, it sounds like you've put a lot of effort into like actually owning the different elements of the business rather than just getting other people to do it. Can you maybe talk us through how that's worked, you know, and how you guys are doing it differently?
Yeah, I think with Thrive, obviously, I mentioned about kind of the quality and the importance of the supply chain for us and how important, you know, getting the right ingredients are. What we do as a business, which sets us apart and, you know, allows us to produce food in the way that we do, we don't outsource anything. We, you know, we take our own orders through our own website. We've got our own ERP system that's managing the process of turning all of those kind of digital numbers into actual real food. From that point, we buy all of the ingredients from suppliers. You know, we've got direct relationships with farmers in the UK. We bring it in. It comes in all on palletized, you know, raw whole peppers, raw whole potatoes, you know, chicken breasts and all of this beautiful produce. Someone actually came in the other day who works at the largest ready meal company in the country and was like, absolutely like mesmerized about the quality and how much we actually do in-house. But we take that through a whole prep process. So we prep all of our own veg, all of our own meat, marinate it all, make all of our own marinades and sauces. We then cook it all. We meal assemble it. So we put it all into the boxes. We then fulfill it as well into our cases. So we manage the whole thing end to end, which is actually, you know, very unique in our space. There's a lot of people in our space that are outsourcing their manufacturing, outsourcing their fulfillment. And they obviously don't tell you that. But, you know, I think you can see in our product, there's a lot of love put into the product. And that kind of is a testament to how much we own of the supply chain.
That seems like the kind of dirty secret of the meal prep world, you know?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of companies that are literally buying cooked frozen food in and just putting it into boxes. And it's like semi-cheating, but, you know, ultimately that's competition. And,
yeah, looking to just kind of elevate our brand through the quality of the service.
It's like that episode of that Josh Peters put out where they were taking ready meals and then serving them on Deliveroo, you know, and just pretending it was a new restaurant.
Yeah.
Now, this is what your competitors are doing, isn't it?
I'm not saying that, but nice. I think with Thrive, you can definitely trust us. As I said, we'll start to get a lot more transparent with the content that we're creating. Now we're just bringing three roles into the business, a videographer, a content creator, and a digital editor, to really kind of just get extremely transparent with what's going on in the company. And at that point, you'll start to see like the level of care that goes into the food manufacturing process. Ultimately, we are a food company.
Yeah.
That is by far the most important thing in our business.
Hopefully. I could not agree with you more. Like, I think having heard this, having seen the quality of the food, I just think people just don't know about it yet. And I think just showing them is going to be transformational for the business. So,
yeah. Definitely part of the strategy, Hugo.
That's epic.
And I get you've double clicked on the tech piece, I guess, and that's amazing. But you also are massively open with both customers and also suppliers, speaking about the farmers, because back in the day, you had a really eggy customer, someone that wasn't overly pleased with what was going on, but you invited them in to have a look at the process, and that changed a lot for you. Feedback's important, but how do you build those relationships and how do you sort of solve issues?
Well, feedback loop is super important. Listening to the customer is the number one thing that we do. I think we kind of like lost sight of customer early last year. We was busy doing projects that, you know, the resource in the business was very heavily focused on operational technology, and there's areas that got neglected. Customer at the beginning of last year was like forgotten about, which was like really horrible to realize after a few months when I realized it. But we've got a continuous feedback loop. We're consistently sending out quarterly surveys. There's through our triggers on Klaviyo, there's survey opportunities for people to give us feedback. And a massive part of this whole feedback loop is the meal ratings. Speaking to industry and potential strategic partners, they target like a 4-star of their ratings of meals from the quality perspective. We're currently running at 4.4-star. So we get like 20,000 meal reviews a week.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a very vast amount of data.
Quick like feedback loop as well, because they literally produce the new recipe, you get a response within a few days, right?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, it's every week, right? So we're constantly tweaking stuff as well. Yeah. Like, you know, if we put a chicken satay out, and, you know, someone says, I don't know, the sauce was runny, let's just say, we'll see that come out instantly in our feedback. So the next time it's on the menu, it's changed.
And no supermarket could do that, right? Like, maybe they get some sample people to test the product before it goes into the supermarket, but you couldn't just put the satay on and then get a feedback loop from those exact customers who bought it.
I got a bit of an understanding of how that works. Like the largest ready meal company in this country, they get something like 100 reviews a month or something like that.
Really?
Because they're selling it through retail.
Yeah.
So they don't.
Can you respond to that? You know, like there's not enough data there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's like, and if you've got that many data points, then it's unbelievably valuable, I guess, when you start to scale the company. So feedback is important, I guess. But in terms of ideating and coming up and innovating, do you have a team of product developers or at least food developers within the business that take you to that? Because a £60 million business is really difficult to do everything on.
No, I don't get too involved in the production of the food now. Well, if I'm on the grill, there's obviously something wrong, right? Reese is the magician when it comes to food. He's our secret weapon when it comes to food. He's the secret sauce. Yeah. He's got a team of people that work for him now. He's got, I think, three people in his team that are, you know, from junior. Like we're looking at, you know, really putting a kind of apprenticeship scheme in the business to kind of grow young talent.
Nice.
But he's got a senior guy that's been with us for a while now, Tom. And then there's a new guy that's just started, and then we're looking at bringing in a junior into the business. But yeah, they're just like constantly at it with the food downstairs.
That must be the most fun job.
Yeah.
With fun new ideas every week.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't got a big shiny MPD kitchen at this stage. It's very much like in the middle of everyone else. It is quite, you know, the business isn't Rolls Royce at the minute. You know, we've got it's a Toyota. We've got the equipment and the tools and everything to make it work. It's not shimmering gold, glimmering
grills, it's what we need.
But that's the difference between raising, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds like some of your competitors have, and then they have the, you know, I've seen there's a test kitchen in Shoreditch for I think it's HelloFresh, and it's that must cost them, you know, 100 grand a week. I think because you've had that constraint, it's forced you to be more scrappy, but also build things right. You know, and yeah, I'm still baffled that you've basically raised no money and built it to £60 million and you own basically all of the business.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. I think, you know, just going back to what you just said there, and something that come out in a conversation the other day is, when you've got no money, you have to fix the issues.
You can't throw money at the problem, right?
Exactly. And I think, and I had a saying, you can't throw people at a shit show because it just becomes a bigger shit show. And that was like an ethos that I was embedding into the company, because a lot, you know, I had managers there that would go, right, oh, there's a problem there, just throw some people at it. And all that does is cost me money. Right, let's go and fix every problem, because and then we create an efficient business. And to show, like, obviously you've seen how capital efficient we've been. What we've got is a 60 million run rate business now that is grown with total efficiency. So now when we do raise money, which we are doing now, we are planning on raising a few million quid to just pump into the business to allow us to grow, invest into kind of various elements, diversifying marketing channels, you know, pushing for more profit enhancing initiatives with equipment and stuff like that, some CapEx investment. So we are raising now, right now, actually, we're raising. But we built this business by fixing all of the problems. And don't get me wrong, there's still loads of problems, but I know that there'd be at least triple if we wasn't in the kind of capital constraints that we've always been under. So it has been a very efficient way of building this business. And, you know, I really am looking forward to the next stage of the journey when we grow it to a few hundred million in revenue. We're building it from a strong foundation where, you know, we have tightened the screws in many areas.
Me again. I promise we'll get back to the episode in a minute. I just wanted to say thanks so much for listening. Hit that subscribe, hit that follow button. It means a lot. We cannot do this podcast without you guys. Back to the episode.
I find it fascinating because entrepreneurs, all entrepreneurs are amazing. Anyone that starts a company is truly incredible. But those that are bootstrapped to business have a very different perspective on running a company to those that have raised capital. What have you learned throughout that process that maybe people who've raised capital haven't learned, other than just being really, really tight with budgets? Like, what are things that you've had to come up against that you wouldn't have to if you had a load of money?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing is if you're not passionate, forget it. Like, you know, I've done a 68-hour shift once where I actually built a factory. So I couldn't afford my rent when I was moved out of Bethnal Green. And they told me they were going to shut the door on me on a Saturday, for instance. I think it was a Saturday. And I basically set up this new factory in Raynham, and I thought I was going to have a week to build it, but then they shut the door on Monday. So in fact, I only had a weekend to build it, and I just had to go in, and I was, you know, putting the walls up. I was doing the plumbing because I'm a plumber by trade. I was doing the plumbing. I put a mezzanine floor up, hung the extraction hood, and I built a facility. And, you know, there's people come and help me throughout that 68 hours, but I was just going at it for 68 hours. I was absolutely like smashed to pieces at the end of it. Once again, my mum came at the end of it and just tidied everything up for me.
Seems like a recurring theme.
Yeah. And the mum always saves us, right? Yeah. So, if you're not that passionate about what you do and you're not willing to like commit your whole life to it and then just forget it. Like, if you've got cash, it's a different story. We can invest strategically, but you know, ultimately, if you're bootstrapping a business, then you need to just be fully all in. And you know, in time that changes. And you know, I'm still fully all in, and you know, I still do the crazy hours every day, you know, working till 11 o'clock at night, pretty much.
Because you love it.
Yeah, exactly. I love it. And I'm seeing it build and I'm seeing it grow. Ultimately, it's my baby, right? But, you know, very recently, I've just brought an executive leadership team in. And as I said earlier, I'm starting to be a bit more outwards facing. And once that team's embedded, I got Christian joining us in March. Christian Dapp, he's currently leading AG1's marketing in the UK.
Amazingly.
Yeah. So he's joining us. I've got Lorne Vary, who's joined us earlier this year. He was running Brompton as CFO and business development officer. Right. He's come on board to support me. And attracting like some of the best talent in the country now. And once they're embedded, they're far better than me in what they do, and they can hold a department. Up until the beginning of last year, it was pretty much me making all of the decisions, make, and I'll tell you a bit about last year and the turbulence actually, but yeah, you know, I got to January last year and I was, it was required to do a step change. I think it was running at about 35, 40 million in January. And I was like, right, this business has now got to be carved into departments in terms of executive leadership. And then we need to build an executive leadership team. And I was naive. I was a naive CEO at the back end, at the beginning of last year when it came to hiring. And a bit of advice that I've got for all entrepreneurs is like, take your hiring seriously because it can go terribly wrong. And if you bring a person into the business got, you know, a lot of control in terms of departmental control that are, you know, pivoting, that are like pivotal departments in strategy, and it's not right, you can come very unstuck. And I pretty much did that last year. And that naivety around hiring's, you know, once again, looking back at it from a positive lens, has been transformable for me as a leader. But it's really taught me the importance of like, understand your org chart, what's your strategy, and hire towards that strategy. Just because someone's got see this on their title doesn't mean that they're the see that that you need. You know, strategically, it makes a difference. And, you know, some people have got, you know, brand backgrounds rather than performance backgrounds in marketing. Some people have got operational backgrounds rather than kind of people management backgrounds in operations. And, you know, those things are super important to understand what you need. And yeah, it got to a point in the business last year where I was touch and go, to be honest. Yeah.
When you say touch and go, obviously measure twice, cut once with the hiring piece.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Super, super key. But touch and go on a 35 to 40 million pound business, people will be listening to this going,
yeah,
how?
Yeah.
So you're printing money, you've got good cash flow. How is that touch?
Yeah. So I built my overheads to take the business to like 60 million revenue last year.
Right.
And I thought I'd built a team to do that.
Pre
the revenue, and I didn't have no funding, right? So, you know, the money that I did make in 2023, I invested £3 million into refurbing our factory in Raynham. And we took on a new factory to kind of open up the scale to grow into. And then I hired these kind of executive leaders in, and it just wasn't right. And they, you know, ultimately my business just started to crumble. And, you know, I stand back and I try and like give these people the space to turn it around because I don't want to be too harsh. And I'm standing back and I'm standing back and I'm going, oh shit, like this is going terribly wrong.
And when did you give them to try and fix it before you went, nah?
Probably a couple of months, I would say, like,
through gritted teeth, or was that you genuinely wanted them to fix it? Were you kind of like, I know what to do?
I knew what to do. That's the annoying thing. Generally, as a founder, like being how obsessed I am with a business and exploring every single department, and I know everything. I project managed the factory that we're in now, which was another whole story about making sure that you're working with the right strategic partners. It's all about people, and it's all about relationships, and it's also about all about, you know, the companies that you're working with to help you on your journey. And, you know, just don't jump into things, like really analyze it, try and get some rapport and some references from other people to understand. Most people are in it for cash, and I'm not in it for cash. I'm in it for doing what's right for humanity. You know, what is a good job? What's trustworthy? What's honest? But a lot of people aren't like that. And then as soon as someone's motivated solely by money, all they care about is how do we make money, right? And not about how do I do the best job for George so he's on his journey and he's being empowered to do what he's doing for humanity.
It'd be super simple for you to make a load of money. You just cut that cost, make it really basic.
Exactly.
Just have a load of processing units coming through.
Yeah.
That takes away what Thrive is all about.
Exactly, yeah. And we've always invested all of our gross margin into, you know, in lifting up our overheads to cater for the next stage of growth. And yeah, going back into it last year, we obviously rebranded as well. And like, so I had like loads of issues at the front end of last year. And me being me, I was in two feet in head first, you know, running at the speed of light. And then we rebranded and, you know, that wasn't done well at all either. And
let's go back to that because it's an important point.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, can you tell us firstly, why did you decide to rebrand? And then how did the actual process go? You know, what are your learnings from that for other entrepreneurs who maybe started with the wrong brand for the long term? Because you were a big business when you rebranded, which is always a tough thing to do.
Yeah, so David Abramovich, who owns Grind.
I know him well. He was on the podcast.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw it, actually. Yeah.
He's a good boy.
He's been helping me out for a few years. And another big thing is that find a mentor that's been there, seen it, done it, and learn from them. And instead of guessing a path to go down, just find out the path to go down, right? And you know, then limit the mistakes that you make, because we all make mistakes. But if you've got a mentor, that would limit the mistakes that you make and make that journey smoother. So me and David always used to speak about, he always used to tell me, George, the name's not right. And I agreed with him. You know, the name had a ceiling. Lions Prep was amazing for 30 to 40 year old males, or, you know, people that were going to the gym. But the business was bigger than that. I always knew it was bigger than that. I'd always been, weirdly, I always knew that it was going to be where it's going. And I was looking for a name that would cater to a much wider audience, you know, cater to, you know, families, much more female, like open to female customers, which we're starting to see the data come through, which is, it's been a success.
Since the rebrand has gone through the roof in terms of the female customer.
It's just a much wider audience now. More women, more families, more, you know, busy professionals rather than just fitness goers.
Gym bros.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
like me.
Yeah. So the name came about. I was looking for a name for ages, actually. We had like purely, you know, like every company turned into Lee at the end. So did you notice that? Yes.
Now it's all .ai.
Yeah. So I was looking for names for a long time, and I was waiting for God to give me the name, because it was just that I knew that I needed a name that would work, which was, you know, I had a few purely, I think we had pure, I forgot some other ones, but I needed that kind of reassurance that this was the name.
Yeah.
I remember being in the office one day, and we was doing like these name exercises, and we built this kind of rebrand but didn't have a name, and it was like part of a process. So we was doing these naming exercises, and the name Thrive came out, because, you know, ultimately our food is there to make people thrive, and it's, you know, it's not going to poison us like some of the food does. It's going to be a food to thrive. It's what Thrive stands for. And I'm in the office, and I'm like, I love the name Thrive. And then someone was like, oh, you sound like you say it with an F. And I was like, yeah, Thrive. That's how a Cockney say it. And they were like, why don't you just call it that? And I just went, bam,
yeah.
F food to thrive. And that's how it came about. So
I knew you were going to say that. And I really wanted that to be the story.
Yeah.
Because I thought it's got to be Thrive. And the way you said it's got to be Thrive.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
I love that.
Yeah. Really good. And that's it. And it just clicked and it worked. And boom, that was the name. But, you know, the rebrand was, you know, I'm sure like most people struggle with rebranding. But
it costs a lot of money, right? You guys basically came up with the name yourself.
Yeah. Well, we did have an external agency that were great, by the way. They, from a creative perspective, they were great. I just think
that looks amazing.
Yeah. It took a little while, though, to be honest. Like, we rebranded, and, you know, a lot. We're an e-commerce business, very digital focused. No one like can walk into the store and speak to someone about why they rebranded. And we just didn't do a good job at relaying that message. You know, it was the brand had been catered to, like, it felt like mums.
Right.
I wasn't a part of the rebrand because of the issues that was happening on the part and the front end of the year. I was kind of consumed in there.
And you were trying to do the rebrand at the same time.
We was doing the rebrand at the same time, and I didn't say stop. And like naively, I should have probably gone like, "Let me do this," because I'm the business, I'm the founder. But I kind of left it in other people's hands, and yeah, it wasn't executed as well as it should have done. It wasn't an absolute disaster, right? It was, we started to like nosedive a little bit as a business post rebrand. We had some operational issues that came around early stage of that rebrand as well. But we started to nosedive slightly, you know, like bit by bit by bit. And, you know, this is where I'm like, I'm standing here and I'm going, right, I'm going to let it happen. All right. And then I just went in and was just like, right, everyone get out of the way. Like, we're sorting this out. And within 9 weeks, we increased revenue by 44% week on week.
So what did you actually do? Because that is a tough thing to do. You've just changed the brand. You know, you've effectively, like, you've changed who your target customer is overnight.
Yeah.
And the business is, you know, nosediving. Like, how on earth did you turn the ship around so quick?
So we've got an office in Canary Wharf, which is where that all the marketing team are. I just went in there and realized very quickly that they'd forgot about customer. They took their eye off competition, and they were kind of like running around in circles. You know, everyone was like burning out. Everyone was working extremely hard. Like, bless them. Like, they were trying their best, but there wasn't much direction. And I kind of went in and was like, right. It took me a week to figure out what was going on. The look and the feel of the brand weren't right. Photography weren't updated. No one knew what they were talking. No one knew what the brand was to do there to do in terms of like the comms, the external comms. It had not been relayed through any of our digital platforms. All of our emails were like samey, very kind of like cartoony. And it was just like, it was shit. And I went in, I basically said like, focus on customer. They started putting surveys out about the customer. We started to get feedback. And then with that feedback, we just become extremely agile. Q4 last year, if you walk into my business, they'll be like, we was just swinging left to right, fixing. And everyone was like, but we was winning at the same time. So it kind of kept everyone motivated.
Keeps the momentum.
Yeah, yeah. So like it was rough. It was very rough seas. And there's a saying that I quite liked, rough seas make skilled sailors. And that's something that I kind of pride myself on. Yeah, and my seas were extremely choppy to maneuver out of it.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, to maneuver out of it was like, it was a miracle. And, you know, under the grace of God, like, I know that was the supporting mechanism for me and guided me through that journey. But we updated, we read an amazing book, the brand team, called Building a Story Brand. And that gave us something called the SB7 framework, which create, you know, all of that. We're going to do a brand and there's going to be pillars and there's going to be all different, you know, we're going to have a 50-page brand, but forget about it. No one knows what that means, right? You want a very clear, decisive and punchy set of rules for a brand, and the story brand, building a story brand, SB7 framework does that amazingly.
Is your framework then? What is your story brand?
You basically, in the SB7 framework, you create the hero first, which is the customer. You create the villain, which in our instance is the large food manufacturing companies. Yeah. And you create like the transformational journey of like why are your hero? We need to protect them from the villain by doing what we do. And then it's our promise. So we identify that these are the people that you're against, and we show people that they can trust us. And what we're doing as a business from a product perspective and a comms perspective to build that trust and that rapport with our customers.
You can see that story though in your ads, you know, like the kind of, you know, the before and after of someone eating all of this crap food and then suddenly now they're eating and it's organic and all of this good stuff. Like you can see how that translates to not just, you know, the big vision for the company, but also like the team executing on like a single creative piece that they're putting out in the ads. I think that's so interesting. I've never heard that framework, but I'm definitely going to apply that.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. And you know, content is something that we've always like, we never got right. And like, there's a lot of investment going into content now to kind of do all that storytelling. Because building a story brand is about, you know, storytelling. And I think, you know, any advice to entrepreneurs that are starting their business now is like, tell the story and just, you know, build a, it's not something that I've done greatly yet and I'm starting to do it now, but build a personal brand if you can, and tell the story of what the company's there to do. You know, who is your customer? Who is your hero? Who are they fighting against and how are you going to help them?
Yeah.
And tell that story consistently.
It's marketing 101, isn't it? Educate, consider decision.
Well, yeah.
That is the reality. But so many people forget the education piece.
Yeah.
And they just go straight to bottom of the funnel, like, right, you guys need to buy now. And you can't thrust that down people's throats.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
Your marketing's great. The visuals are lovely. Like, we're being served it all the time in the last couple of weeks. It looks really, really incredible.
You've turned the cannon to us just before you come onto the podcast.
Good. What does Thrive sort of stand for? What is your mission statement? What do you want to do? Yeah. How can people sort of find out more about you guys and how can they become a customer?
Yeah, so Thrive are here to revolutionize the food system. We're using the meal prep industry and the convenience of meal prep that saves, you know, hours, 7 hours a week on average, to create a convenient mechanism to allow us to go into the food system and rid it from its toxicity. You know, ultimately, every mouthful that we put in our food that's conventional food, which is what everyone eats, and it's going to take some time to stop that, but you're ingesting, you know, these harmful chemicals that are being sprayed on crops and, you know, hormones that are being pumped into the animals and, you know, the disease preventing chemicals that are being flooded in the seas that are in these farms. And, you know, the animals and the plants are ingesting this stuff and then we're ingesting it. And, you know, ultimately it's hurting us as humans. This stuff shouldn't be in our body.
No.
So the goal for Thrive is to restore food back to its natural form. How you know, nature created it for us. We want to go back to the supply chain. I want to get into the vertical supply chain. There will be fry farms at some point where it will be fully organic, and revolutionizing the food system. And yeah, but doing it in a way which is super convenient, tastes amazing. You know, we're not going there, we're going to make this super healthy food, but it's going to be bland and boring. Like, if you try our food, some of them are perfection. You know, they are such amazingly flavored food. You know, the aromas that come from just opening the film once you come out of the microwave, it's like the flavors are there. So we've got the rest, you know, we've got a product that is convenient, and it's a D2C mechanism that people love, and clearly they love it, right? But you know, behind the scenes, our actual vision statement is to transform health by revolutionizing eating habits and restoring food back to its natural form. And, you know, that's what underpins the company's ethos. When we're doing food creation and NPD strategies, it's all rooted in that ethos. And that ethos is spread across the company, and everyone knows what they're working for and working towards.
And how do I buy Thrive then? Where do I go? What do I do?
Yeah, so it's solely an e-commerce brand at the minute. We are looking at different opportunities in more physical spaces, but yeah, solely digital at the minute. www.thrive.co.uk. You'll see us on Instagram. We're just getting into YouTube. We're on TikTok. We're starting to get into kind of more physical advertising spaces now. But yeah, www.thrive.co.uk. There's a really strong introductory discount for people to try the food. I really recommend reading the CRM and the emails that come after to kind of allow us to educate you and what we actually do and why we do it. But yeah, online subscription, can cancel anytime. You can pause at any time. There's no kind of, you're in a customer now, we're going to keep you forever. Like, totally flexible. I want people to love the brand and love what we're doing. And, you know, ultimately, the more people join us and subscribe to us, the more power and resource we have to be able to invest into our vision, which is to create a healthier society.
It's awesome. And just to kind of wrap up the episode today, obviously this is the most like super inspiring story that you've got. How can people follow you directly? You know, because I think I certainly want to see the next few years. And you know, how can we follow your journey as you go through the building the business?
Yeah, something my brand team are pushing me for now, which I'm definitely open to. There will be some social accounts opening up. I am on LinkedIn, I am on Instagram, but it's not necessarily been a public strategy at this stage. Now I've built the business and the team are there holistically across the board. We're able to continuously improve. I'm now able to step out and do more things like this and grow the kind of personal brand side of what I'm doing. So you'll start to see more and more of me, as you saw me on some ads talking. That stuff's kicking in now. And I'm seeing it as a great opportunity to build faith and trust in the brand. And, you know, ultimately, if it's from my voice, it's happening. So everything that I say, I truly mean. And you'll start to see more and more of me on digital platforms.
It's amazing. As we see, you know, you going from the founder hustling all the way through to being, you know, truly a CEO and kind of looking at the horizon. I'm so excited to watch it all unfold. So well done. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah.
Cheers, George.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it.
That's a wrap for this episode of Success is in the Mind with me, Oliver Bruce, and Hugo Tilmouth. We hope you enjoyed today's conversations and have taken away some valuable insights to fuel your own journey. If you liked what you heard, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who needs a little bit of inspiration. You can also follow us on social media for the behind-the-scenes content. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, keep pushing forward, stay curious, and remember, success is always in the mind.